This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, you'll hear from Emmy Award-winning comedian Kathy Griffin.
And there's something about this tour, the way the audiences are showing up, it's like a freaking hug. And I know that sounds corny, and don't worry, I'm still so vulgar that I probably could get arrested for that again.
She'll be appearing live at the Fremont in San Luis Obispo June 9th. Also, it's rattlesnake season. Emily Taylor, professor of biology at Cal Poly, is the author of the book California Snakes and How to Find Them.
The most amazing thing about rattlesnakes is their social lives. Rattlesnakes form social bonds where they have friends that they hang out with.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 3rd, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Extreme heat is considered one of the deadliest climate-related hazards. Although the Central Coast is known for its moderate climate, projections for the region show an increase in frequency and severity of heat waves in the coming decades. In our four-part series about extreme heat on the Central Coast, KCBX reporter Beth Thornton speaks with scientists, health experts, and local nonprofit organizations about the different ways people can stay safe during high temperatures. This afternoon, we'll hear the last part of this series. Girls Inc. in Carpinteria is a girls' leadership program and a place for after-school care. Now it's a climate resilience hub for the neighborhood, too. The nonprofit is prepared to serve as a community gathering space during extreme heat events.
Carpinteria is located on the south coast of Santa Barbara County. The local economy thrives on agriculture, tech, and tourism. And anyone traveling between Los Angeles and San Francisco passes through on the 101, with a view of the ocean on one side and farms and mountains on the other. At the Girls Inc. campus on Foothill Road, there are solar panels on the roof, shade trees near the playground, and air-conditioned classrooms. It's one of three pilot locations selected by the county to become a place for locals to gather during climate-related events. Jamie Collins, the executive director at Girls Inc., says it's a natural fit.
Carpinteria doesn't have a community center. We become geographically isolated when major storms hit, the freeway shut down, we don't have a hospital. You know, there's all of these things that we don't have access to.
Collins is talking as she gives a tour. She says there's a mix of air conditioning, fans, and shade.
So I think on campus we could probably have between 300 and 500 people.
They also have a large kitchen with a food pantry and a side alleyway for deliveries if needed.
Easy access if we needed to bring in, you know, additional cooling options. And then the generator would connect right into our giant panel right here in the alley.
The backup generator is coming soon. It's an important feature, since extreme heat days often come with fire danger and wind that can lead to grid outages. Between the solar panels and backup generator, the hub will still have air conditioning and lights if Carpinteria's electricity goes down. Collins says the program matches their community-minded goals as an organization. She says that besides their after-school programs, Girls Inc. also runs a summer camp, so she regularly sees parents and family members coming and going all year round.
We have parents here on a daily basis. We host monthly family engagement nights also to provide families with information and resources around how to respond to, you know, extreme weather, including heat.
The neighborhood hub will activate during extreme heat events. Collins says her on-site staff is trained in CPR and first aid, and the location will be open for anyone who needs support. Garrett Wong is the climate program manager for the County of Santa Barbara. He works closely with the agencies and nonprofits managing the hub program. He says extreme heat days, when temperatures are unusually high, are projected to increase in frequency on the Central Coast, and it's one of the county's climate concerns.
Extreme heat affects people who are not used to heat. So in a mild climate, it doesn't take a lot of high temperature to actually stress a body out.
Wong says the county received a grant from the state of California to create a few neighborhood hubs. Then local organizations applied to the program, and three were selected.
One was in Nukuyama, which is in the northern part of our county. One was in the east side of Santa Barbara, and then one was in Carpinteria.
He says each location has its own unique needs, but they all serve populations that have fewer resources and are vulnerable during times of extreme weather events.
They all serve communities that we would consider to be among the vulnerable populations, either due to the fact that they may not speak English as their primary language, or they may be lower income status, or they may be living in more rural, remote locations, or they might be living in renter situations.
Wong says the three sites were already well connected in their communities, so the grant helped to retrofit existing locations, build capacity, and train personnel for emergency operations. He says the county continues to apply for grants from the state to help build climate resilience through projects like this, but it's a competitive process.
And so I think that tells us two good things. You know, one is that, you know, the state is still willing to put funding towards this, and this is only the beginning, really. And two, there is a massive appetite for doing this work. People are willing to come together and come up with creative solutions.
Wong says, ideally, neighborhood hubs will exist up and down the Central Coast in the coming years. As we wrap up our series, The Heat Beat, remember that most heat-related illnesses and deaths can be prevented. Finding solutions as a community, like cooling centers, worker protections, and home upgrades, will make extreme heat days safer for all residents on the Central Coast. For KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton.
This project is made possible by a grant from the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, KCBX's Sal Espana speaks with Emmy Award-winning comedian Kathy Griffin.
I'm Sal Espana, and we are talking with legendary comedian Kathy Griffin, who will be performing at the Fremont Theater on June 9th. Hi, Kathy. How are you doing today?
I am so excited to come to the Fremont. First of all, I'm excited to be alive. I call the show Kathy Griffin, My Life on the PTSD List Tour, because I've freaking been diagnosed with PTSD. And I have to laugh because, well, first of all, I thought it was only for combat veterans. But leave it to me to get PTSD. And then I talk about all the stuff. I mean, there's a lot of good celebrity stories. Don't worry, I haven't changed that much. But, honey, I'm telling you, I talk about PTSD. I don't talk about Trump unless he's, you know, passing gas in court that day.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be clean for NPR. And even then, I'd only talk about it for a minute or two. But I talk about everything from cancer. I had lung cancer, even though I never smoked. I have half a lung on my left side. I make fun of that. My voice is a bit altered. You can tell because I was injured during the lung cancer surgery. Leave it to me to have the good luck of the Irish. You said you're married to a Griffin. You know what that means. And I talk about addiction. I became freaking addicted to prescription pills after the Trump thing. There's some comedy in becoming a junkie at 57 years old. Sorry, I just have to laugh at myself. I'm now, by the way, 3 years and 10 months in recovery, but I make fun of recovery because that's funny too. And I just make fun of cancer. I am getting divorced at 63 years young. I very much want to be the next Golden Bachelor. Hello? Where's the campaign for me to be the next Golden Bachelorette?
Well, you got to get out there.
Thank you very much. I want you to get off this phone and call the head of ABC and tell them I'm not as controversial as you think, but I still got it, baby. 63, single, and sexy. And I ask the audience, if you've ever been touched by addiction in any way, clap. And they all clap. So nice. That tells me, okay, it's okay to make jokes about this. So I do that, and then I string it with a bunch of ridiculous celebrity stories. I have a story about going to Paris Hilton's Christmas party. I have a story about going on vacation with my friend, the amazing singer-songwriter Sia. And, you know, I'm still the old Kathy, but just a little more traumatized.
Now, you started in the Groundlings. What is it about that group that has led to so many successful comedy careers?
You know, it's interesting because I'm a Chicagoan. So I was raised on worshiping Second City. So So when I moved to Los Angeles, they had a free paper at the time, the LA Weekly, and I saw the ad for the Groundling Theater, and it was the closest thing to Second City that I could find. And it was something like my first week in Los Angeles. I was 18 years old, 19 maybe, and I went to see the Groundlings, which is on Melrose. It's still there. It's a great improv sketch theater group. And my very first night, I saw the show. I was blown away. I love improvisation, and you're going to love this. I was so ballsy. I walked backstage right after the show by myself. I think I took a bus to go see the show. And I walked back to who I thought was the funniest person in the entire cast. And I went up to him, and he must have thought, who is this girl just walking around? And I just was so innocent, and I said, you're amazing, and how do I get to do this? And he was so patient with me and explained how there's a school, and then you have to take the classes. Anyway, that man's name was Phil Hartman. And I know Phil's death was very tragic, but the Phil I knew for many years was a real mentor. And I've been very lucky in my career that between the Groundlings and some of the great people I was in there with, Lisa Kudrow, Phoebe from Friends, Lisa actually pulled me aside one time, and I mention this every time I see her, and she said, you know, you're really good in the Groundlings, but I actually think you're funniest as yourself. And so Lisa was actually the person that convinced me to go from doing just sketch comedy to standing there by myself, telling my little stories about whatever happened to me that week. And then later on, that morphed into celebrity stories because I finally started getting little teeny weeny parts on TV shows or commercials. And then that led me into, you know, getting out of situation comedy with Brooke Shields. And then I got my first HBO special, and it went on from there. But the Groundlings was a great teacher for me because my stand-up style is still highly improvisational. So I don't know what I'm going to say on stage on any given night, much more than the audience does. I mean, okay, I have a general idea of where I'm going, but I still like to keep it really improvisational. And so sometimes I get heat, like Jerry Seinfeld, like I don't think he thinks I'm like a real comic because he's very perfect. You know, he writes his act out on his computer. He puts the commas in the right place, and he puts the periods in the right place. And God love him. He's an American treasure. I got to be on Seinfeld twice. I have nothing against Jerry. But that's just not how I know how to do it. So I think because I was trained in the Groundlings with some of the greats, I mean, Will Ferrell was my Groundling student.
Nice.
Student. And yet, even as a, you know, even as the teacher, you're kind of working with the students. And so I was lucky to be surrounded for years by really some of the great comic talents of our time. And then, you know, I started stand-up at the tender age of 36. I mean, who starts stand-up at 36? And so I'm a late bloomer, but I've been doing it ever since. And I, you know, was lucky enough to, like I said, finally get my first special only because I was on an NBC sitcom. I remember the head of HBO telling me, because I said, well, how did you pick me for a special, my first hour special? He goes, because you're a girl and because you're on a big show. And we got to do a certain amount of girls every year. And I asked him, I go, how many? He goes, one. And so that hasn't changed all that much, I'm sorry to say. But I said, I'll take it. I don't care the reason. And I'm now in the Guinness Book of World Records because I have actually done more televised stand-up comedy specials than any comedian, male or female, living or dead. And, you know, I loved every minute of it, and I would love to get another special, and I'm still hoping this tour leads to another special somewhere.
It probably will. You've performed around the world, including for our troops overseas. What was that like?
Yeah. I performed in Afghanistan and Iraq. I'm 2 years apart. When I performed in Afghanistan, I went with the USO. And let me tell you, it's an experience every performer should be mandated to do. because going to Afghanistan, I'll tell you the first thing, it's not funny, I'm sorry, but the first thing that hit me was I looked out in the audience at the first little show that I did, and they're kids. You know, you forget the majority of our military is 18, 19-year-old kids. And the ones that are 21 or 22 have two or three kids of their own. And so that's why I think it should be mandatory for all performers to do it, because it's an environment that you have to really be aware of who your audience is, how far you can go. I will be honest, no pun intended, I bombed so badly my first show in Afghanistan, I just burst into tears. And then I remembered they give you this whole written rules and regulations, all the things you can't do. So the next show, I read from that aloud, and then I inserted jokes, and it killed because they were laughing so hard that, like, you weren't supposed to ever curse. As if people don't curse in the military, please. The other thing is they said, whatever you do, do not dare make fun of the officers. Well, I'm awful. I would bring the highest level officer up. Of course, it was a man. I would sit on his lap. I would make fun of him. I would flirt with him. And then I realized, okay, they want you to make fun of the dire situation they are in. And I know that sounds like an odd directive, but it makes sense when you think about it. I was in FOBS, the forward operating base. You're out there, man, and you're on a tent. And I was standing on a Costco table with no microphone, and sometimes you're performing for, you know, 25, 26 guys. And I say guys because it's still primarily male. And then I would do a show where there'd be a couple thousand, but it was an outdoor, they had set up some kind of a stage. And then I remember one time in Afghanistan, I was in the middle of my set, and all the lights went out and all the sound went out. And I'm sitting there like, what's going on? Very calmly, some guy walks out and says, oh, Miss Griffin, this is because the enemy's flying overhead, and we have to go dark. And don't worry, nobody will leave. And I remember it was 23 minutes, because I kept thinking, well, these poor guys are going to not keep just sitting here, right? And sure enough, 23 minutes later, everything went back up. I made jokes about that, of course. But it was such a rewarding and life-altering experience to just be in their presence. And when I got back from, in particular, Iraq, because I was able to take the crew from Kathy Griffin, My Life on the D-List, to the Iraq visit, which, by the way, they've just started re-airing the entire series on Peacock. And I really hope people watch it and rediscover my parents and fall in love with them. But I was very proud of the episodes that I got to do in Iraq, because I'm very good friends with a colonel, two lieutenant colonels, and they gave me access that my little crew from Bravo never would have gotten. And sometimes one of the officers would get so mad at me because I was too vulgar, and he would go, Griffin! And I'd be like, yes, sir. And he'd go, go to the mess hall and just, I don't know, just sit down at that table and start talking to people and trying to make them laugh while they're eating. And I'd be like, that's where I shine. And so my joke would be my best shows where I would just be sitting in the mess hall and, so, you know, they're younger, so they go, oh, my mom loves you, or my aunt loves you, or my sister loves you. And, you know, I would just do that and make people laugh. You know, you're over there, you're going to do whatever they want. But, I mean, when I even look back on that, the fact that I slept in Saddam's palace is just insane. Like, to this day, I can't believe it. And that they let our little My Life on the D-List crew, I think we only brought 4 people total, and that they let us film in Saddam's palace, and the whole thing was so surreal. But you can't ever lose sight of the fact that these young, primarily young men and women, are in an environment that I don't think they possibly could have fathomed. I mean, does it, you know, look, I'm from Chicago, right? I'm like a typical Illinoisan. The thought that I would even go to Afghanistan, which I couldn't find on a map. I'm not going to lie. I didn't go to college. I'm a dumbass. And the fact that I went there with so many of these men and women that sign up for an environment itself that is so foreign, and yet we got to figure out, they got to do their job. I finally figured out how to do my job at the cost of course, the officers who all like wanted to kill me. But I didn't care about the few officers. I cared about the young men and women that just needed a laugh so bad. And I performed in AIDS hospices. One time, the great Joan Rivers and I were in London. And this is a weird story. She was very good friends with Chuck and Camilla. And I laughingly call them Chuck and Camilla, but she did. And she was very good friends with them, but she didn't talk about that a lot. So one time she said, I'm going to London to visit Chuck and Camilla for a two-night event, and Melissa's bored with them. She doesn't want to go. And it's one night at Windsor and one night at Buckingham. Do you want to go with me? Yes, I do. We did that, and we're in our ball gowns. And she said, you know, I have a friend who is in the end stages of AIDS. Do you think the hospital would let us in? I said, Joan. England was in love with Joan. And so we were in our Oscar de la Renta or whatever ball gowns. We went to the hospital. They just took a look at Joan Rivers. And that's what we did after being at Buckingham Palace. That was Joan's idea. And, you know, I think when you're a comic, that should be part of the gig, man. I think if you're lucky enough to have this job, and Joan would always say to me, in our last dinner even, Joan would look at me and go, Lord, we're lucky. Look at how lucky we are. We get paid to make people laugh. And I live that every minute, especially having gone through the Trump experience and not having permission to just do my job, my profession, for 7 years. Man, that damn near killed me. So every single show is a gift. I love every single show.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. Sal Espana is speaking with comedian Kathy Griffin, who will be performing at the Fremont Theater in San Luis Obispo June 9th.
Now, as you mentioned, you've had a hellacious past few years, and you've incorporated your experience into your new My Life on the PTS List tour. First of all, how did you survive?
I wish I knew. Barely. Honey, let me tell you, this PTSD thing is no joke. And I don't mean to gross you out, and I apologize, but the way it manifests in me is if I have a flare-up, I just can't stop vomiting. So then I become dehydrated. I have to go to the hospital and get saline, IV drip. Now there's companies that can come to your house and do that. But I have just survived by doing what I just done my whole life, which is just putting one foot in front of the other. And I got to thank my crazy parents for that, my crazy family. I love to make fun of them, but my parents were depression parents. And I grew up with my mom and dad saying, use it up, wear it out, make it do, never stop, never quit. And so it was the Trump thing. It was losing friends. It was becoming addicted to prescription pills. It was trying to take my life. It was being on a 5150 psych hold for 3 days. I even make fun of that. It was getting into recovery. Then it was being diagnosed with lung cancer. It was losing half a lung. Then getting injured during the lung surgery. And as you can tell, my voice is a bit altered. So now I use a special headset microphone, which has been a game changer. And then filing for divorce 5 months ago. And I certainly never thought I'd be 63 and single, but I am. And it's just putting one foot in front of the other. But I will tell you, knowing I have shows coming up has been a game changer. I don't care. You know, I got to go see my ENT throat doctor again today because I'm always having to have my freaking vocal cords checked out. And it's just part of my, you know, whatever, since my cancer. But knowing that I have a show on the schedule is the thing. I could do cartwheels. I don't care if I have half a lung. I don't care if I lose the other half. You can actually be fine with one lung. I learned that. But whatever it is, and I do talk about this in the show, and I try to make it funny, but when you're at your most down and out, you got to put one foot in front of the other. Even if you stumble and fall, and man, I'm like the poster child for stumbling, and I'm always getting fights with people. Even when I was canceled, and by canceled, I mean investigated by the Department of Justice, by two agencies within the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Secret Service, being put on the no-fly list, being put on the Interpol list, which meant if I was going to go perform for the troops again, I wouldn't be able to fly to freaking Iraq, you know, where we still have troops. Like, the insanity of that, frankly, the other stuff I could almost kind of handle. I mean, barely, honey. There's days when I'm hanging on by, as my mom would say, a song and a prayer. But laughter and connecting with people, and there's something about this tour, the way the audiences are showing up, it's like a freaking hug. And I know that sounds corny. And don't worry, I'm still so vulgar that I probably could get arrested for that again. But these audiences, it's kind of like they know. It's, if you're coming to, as I said, I don't have an opener because I just have so much that I want to get out. I do 2 hours. I write every bit of it myself. Sometimes I accidentally do 2 hours in 20 minutes. I have to be dragged off stage because I'm just so excited to be able to do my job, to make people laugh. It's the greatest thing in the world. So I hope people come to see me when they're having a bad day. I hope somebody doesn't buy a ticket and then go, well, I'm having a tough day, I'll just stay home and eat ice cream. No, get out of the house. Go to the Kathy Griffin Show. I know the title sounds like PTSD is scary, but I'm going to make it funny. And I'm going to throw in the celebrity stuff. You're going to get it all, but just put one foot in front of the other.
Do you have any advice for people dealing with PTSD? Would that just be get one step one foot in front of the other, or do you have any more advice?
I say, and this is the hardest part, but it's when you're down and out at the most. Like, you know, I'm bitching about my divorce a lot because, like I said, I just thought I was going to be with this guy forever, and heartbreak sucks, and I'm going through heartbreak. But it will get better. And so when it happened, oh, my gosh, it was Christmas time. You know, the timing couldn't have been worse. I'm calling divorce lawyers on Christmas Eve. That in itself is sort of funny. Like, being in Malibu and calling these, like, freaking snobby Beverly Hills divorce attorneys, oh, please. They're too busy going on TV. Some of these divorce attorneys are more famous than I am. And so I thought that was sort of funny. Every divorce attorney I called was in, like, St. Bart's. St. Bart's! That's a uniquely Hollywood problem. So I wrote that down on a cocktail napkin. And so I say to people, it's when you're in fetal position, sucking your thumb, crying, you think you don't have a friend of the world. That's the moment where if you can just look around, whoever you are, if you can just look around and take that 1 second and find one silly thing and go, you know what? Maybe I don't think this is funny now, but in 5 months, I'm going to be able to laugh about this. That's my advice. It's at your most down and out moment. Look around. Have a good, solid, thorough look around. You're going to find something that's somehow funny. And maybe it's only funny to you, but find the funny. And it really is the best medicine. I've been there. I've lived it. I attest to that.
The show is called My Life on the PTSD List, June 9th at the Fremont Theater. For more information, you can go to kathygriffin.com. Thank you, Kathy Griffin, for speaking with us.
Oh, you're a doll, Phil. I really, really appreciate it. And I hope everybody comes to the show and laughs their you-know-what off.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. It's been 10 years since the Isla Vista mass killings, and reporter Alyssa Toledo checks in with journalist Mark Fullman, whose Mother Jones article, published recently, features a conversation with the killer's mother.
All right, Mark, thank you so much for making time to chat with me today. I'd love to ask you what your initial impression of Chin Roger was. How did you find her, and what did that initial conversation look like?
Well, Chin Roger is quite a unique figure in the terrain of this subject matter of mass shootings. I've been investigating this subject for more than a decade, and I've interviewed many, many people around this problem from all sides of it: survivors, victims, parents, FBI agents, police, psychologists, educators, on and on. I had never heard of someone like Chin Roger before. I had never before heard of a parent of a perpetrator, of a mass shooter, who was willing to engage the horrific story of her own son's crime and suicide in order to try to help with the mission of prevention, to go deep into the case and share what she knows and knew about her son, that even with the deep investigation that happened after this event, there were many things, of course, that a parent might know that wouldn't have been known even to investigators. She was very, very reluctant to talk to me, to any journalist. She told me many times in the course of my interviews with her that she's always been very worried about bringing any kind of additional harm to the victims' families. And she long felt that speaking publicly could do that. So she was silent for many years. But eventually she came to believe that engaging with violence prevention in the way that she has could potentially help prevent other tragedies and save other lives. And she wanted to do that. And so that's why she came forward and began speaking with me.
You know, you've covered hundreds of mass shootings in your 12 years of reporting. How did your prep for this differ from how you prepared for other individuals who have been involved or affected by mass shootings over the years?
One of the things that really drew me to her story was thinking about how the parent of a perpetrator is someone who we almost never hear from. And I think that the public really doesn't think about much. You know, I thought a lot about how to begin to talk with her and learn about her experience through the lens of trauma reporting, but then also with that in mind too, that this was kind of going into territory that we know very little about and could be potentially very interesting and valuable to better understanding what this problem is all about. And that's always been my purpose in focusing on this subject, as I have for so long. This all had to be handled very, very sensitively and carefully, and it took a while to really think through the best way to tell this story, I think, to sort of take into account all of the delicacies of it, the mother, and then also the victims. I mean, this was top of mind for me throughout my reporting too, and it always is with this subject. The people who suffer directly from these attacks, who lose loved ones, the parents of the victims, the family members, and then the broader community. Because let's be honest, this subject comes up a lot. It's recurring. It starts to become numbers and statistics. You know, how many died this time? How many, you know, and the debate over guns and how many mass shootings a year and all these things that sort of reduce the humanity of these events in certain ways. And so I felt it was really important to have that woven into this project as well. Approaching the problem of mass shootings through this subject of prevention became very compelling to me. And so with Chin Rogers' engagement, I knew that there would be a really potentially deep and valuable story there.
When you sat down and started piecing all of this together, did you go in knowing what the focal point was going to be? Did you kind of find it as you started writing and honing in? What did that look like?
Well, I had some hunches, and one of them proved out in a very interesting way, and that's the subject matter focus on the so-called incel phenomenon. I knew when, after the case had happened, that the way that was discussed in media coverage and then quickly became prevailing narrative about Elliot's self-identity and motive, I had the sense that that was an oversimplification at best. that of course, knowing what I knew about the complexity of mass shooters' psychology and behavior, that there was going to be a lot more to the story than that. And there was. And what was kind of surprising to discover was that with a much more comprehensive study of case evidence, and there's a lot of evidence that I was able to obtain and that I write about in the story that was not public until now, there's a much clearer picture of that complexity about the process that Elliot went through toward violence and what led to that, what fed into it. And the notion that extreme misogyny or incel ideology was fundamentally what caused him to do what he did is really misleading. That's really not the case at all. And that's true with all mass shooters in a fundamental way, that there isn't any one thing that explains motive or that answers the question of why someone does this. Even though I think there's enormous public appetite to have that kind of an explanation, it's very rare that a case can be clearly explained simply through an ideological belief system or a specific condition of mental health or mental illness. It's another big myth about this problem too, that mental illness is the fundamental cause. That's also wrong. And I talk about that a lot in the story as well. What I learned about Elliot's connection to, you know, these so-called incel movement or incel forums online was really different. The reality of that was really different than the way it was portrayed in the media. And that really took on a life of its own 10 years ago and has been the narrative ever since. And it's caused a really bad copycat problem too. There are a lot of imitators who cite Elliot Rodger as an inspiration or say that they're attacking because of incel ideology. And so that mythologizing of him has actually been very unhelpful and destructive in some ways. And this was a really interesting, I think, discovery for me in reporting out the story, and something that I wanted to make very explicit in my reporting, that the incel copycat phenomenon of shooters is in some ways built on mythology, on a myth, and it's misleading. And by continuing to repeat that story over and over about this case, the media is really perpetuating, in my view, a bad thing, that we shouldn't continue to repeat that story in that way. And perhaps, you know, would be able to diminish it if we stop doing that.
If you're just joining us, reporter Alyssa Toledo is speaking with journalist Mark Folman, whose Mother Jones article published for the 10th anniversary of the Isla Vista mass killings features a conversation with the killer's mother.
With this piece in particular, what kind of, if any, dilemmas did you face when reporting on this, and how did you kind of navigate them?
Well, I had all of that in mind, certainly, especially with a case like this that was so high profile and emotionally charged, and then became the subject of you know, this very intense debate over extreme misogyny and graphic entertainment. You may recall that there was a big outpouring online after this case that went viral with the hashtag #YesAllWomen, where lots of women were talking about their very real horrific experiences of misogynistic abuse. And so to whatever extent that was not necessarily the reality of what was driving Elliot Rodger, that was a very real effect and outcome. And so I felt that this all had to be handled very, very sensitively and carefully. And it took a while to really think through the best way to tell this story, I think, to sort of take into account all of the delicacies of it, the mother, and then also the victims. I mean, you know, this was top of mind for me throughout my reporting too, and it always is with this subject. The people who suffer directly from these attacks, who lose loved ones, the parents of the victims, the family members, and then the broader community. I spent time in Isla Vista, where this took place 10 years ago, for the story, and spoke to people there who were there and experienced it, and there is enormous impact from these events. And I felt that it was important to include that in the story too, even though the central focus was Chin Rogers' experience as the mother and how she was helping this field of violence prevention, to still find ways to incorporate that part of the story. And I did that by speaking with a parent of one of the victims who was killed, Richard Martinez, who lost his son in that attack, including the voices of some of the wounded survivors who spoke out in the media afterward, and making sure to tell that part of the story as well, I think, to have the right balance, reminding people of the impact that this has in very real ways on real people in communities. Because let's be honest, this subject comes up a lot. It's recurring. It starts to become numbers and statistics. You know, how many died this time? You know, and the debate over guns and how many mass shootings a year and all these things that sort of reduce the humanity of these events in certain ways. And so I felt it was really important to have that woven into this project as well.
Considering the many people that you've interviewed and the tragedies that you've covered over the years, what is one key insight that you wish the general public could understand about mass shootings and the psychology behind them?
I think a really crucial theme for me, really, to rethink who the people are that do this. These are people who do this. This is a human behavior. I mean, certainly what mass shooters do is evil. Their acts are evil. They cause terrible suffering and destruction. But they're human beings who are acting a certain way that we can understand. And the notion that they're inexplicable, insane, evil monsters, which I think is bandied about to this day in the aftermath of these events, is counterproductive. And so that's something that I really hope comes through in my reporting, that we can solve this problem. These aren't inevitable attacks. These are behaviors that can be identified, and people can be helped, and there can be intervention. It may not work in every case, but there are certainly many cases that I've seen where that was possible or probable, and there are cases where it has succeeded. And I've looked at a lot of cases like that too. So I think ultimately, this is, though it's a very heavy and dark subject, it's a hopeful story. It's a story of progress. This is a constructive way to think about it. And that's what I want and hope people will take away from my work.
Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure to do it, Alyssa. And I appreciate you taking the time to read the story and do this great interview.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangerman. Up next, the Live Oak Music Festival is coming up June 14th through the 16th. Contributor Kathy Johnston has this story.
At El Choro Regional Park near San Luis Obispo, the golden meadows dappled with trees are about to witness a bustle of activity. The Live Oak Music Festival relies on hundreds and hundreds of hardworking volunteers to transform these peaceful fields into a well-planned, well-run gathering for people of all ages. In the week before the music festival begins, teams of volunteers come together at the park. They run electrical lines, set up fencing, build and decorate three stages, and install sound systems. Others set up a kitchen and serve meals, create a children's area, lay out a marketplace, erect signs, establish camping areas, and do a myriad of other jobs. And that doesn't even include the volunteers who do the pre-festival planning and marketing, and those who work during the festival to run the stages and the sound, keep the grounds clean, drive the shuttle, lead the children's activities, and much more. Many of these volunteers have been a part of the Live Oak Music Festival for decades, some ever since the first festival in 1989. Now there's a new generation discovering the joys of taking part in this fundraiser for KCBX. Courtney Davis joined the construction crew a few years ago, helping to set up all the perimeter fencing.
One of the great things about Live Oak is that it's really intergenerational. So there are people who grew up coming here and have themselves become volunteers, and their children are now becoming volunteers. And it's really important to have a next generation of people come about. But it's also really important just to support KCBX in that way, to be able to donate your time and help support a nonprofit that's so beloved in San Luis. I think it's really important for people to know how much heart and soul Live Oak has. There's so many music festivals nowadays, and they're all these grandiose, huge productions. But Live Oak just has this really family-centered, community-centered atmosphere and ambiance to it that other music festivals just do not have. And it's really special that we get to have it in San Luis Obispo. And it's even more special to get to be part of the team that puts it all together and to get to support it in that way. And without volunteers, it won't continue happening. It's just a really fun community to get to be a part of. There are so many familiar faces. You see people at Live Oak sometimes, you know, any time of year that you see them. And so getting to be a part of the crew that makes it all happen and doing it with people that you know and love is really fun and exciting. And it always just creates great memories for me.
Quite a few volunteers, young and not so young, say they couldn't even imagine coming to Live Oak without being part of the team that puts it all together and keeps it running smoothly. During the days before the festival opens to the public, volunteers from various crews are strengthening bonds and getting to know each other. They gather for a potluck dinner, where volunteers meet and mingle, talk and laugh, over an assortment of camp food and drinks. Rebecca Literal started volunteering at age 16 and is now in charge of the festival marketplace. For her, Live Oak is a family and a support system.
You can just see the amount of work that goes into Live Oak. Watching from Monday to Friday, we build a whole city, and it's amazing, and there is so much commitment and work from everyone, from the founders to the brand new volunteers. Everyone loves and is committed to seeing this through. It's this amazing sense of satisfaction of just watching something grow and build out of nothing. And everyone's always so open to, well, how can we do it better? What can we do to make things the best they can be for this festival?
Volunteers on the electrical crew say they share the satisfaction that comes from being part of this important KCBX fundraiser. Mike Mannon has been volunteering for Live Oak for 10 years. He enjoys seeing the festival come to fruition, in part because of his contribution.
Everyone that does the volunteer work is kind of like a big family, and I get to come back and see them every year, and then we get to do something fun. We get to throw everything together, and I love seeing how it comes together. So, you know, some of it's hard work, but most of it's not hard work. So I don't feel like I'm working when I do it, and I think people would really enjoy coming and volunteering.
All the volunteers are especially heartened to know the Live Oak Music Festival raises funds for KCBX and its diverse programs. For Sean Collins, though, that support goes both ways. Sean has been volunteering for Live Oak for 10 years or so, serving on several different crews. Now he helps out with the stage construction.
Well, Live Oak has a really special community to my heart, so I'm going to get emotional, oh my gosh, but basically I've learned a lot just from being able to volunteer here and to be around people and to, you know, have that sort of like party, but also like loving community vibe. I really have always enjoyed that. I've grown from being here. I've grown from being around people. My ability to socialize has gotten better. You know, I have a better grasp on like mental health from being here, because just the way that you have to interact with people. People can be so kind, and the Live Oak way is just such a special thing. So yeah, I feel supported almost from KCBX because of the fundraiser too, and so because Live Oak's a fundraiser, right? So I feel supported in that way because it's just been such a big part of my life.
After working every Live Oak since the beginning, one retiring crew leader told his distraught people not to be anxious about how they'd remember everything without his leadership. "Don't worry," he told his crew, "we have tribal memory. One person remembers 90%, another remembers 90%, and you all work together." These days, the younger volunteers are gaining tribal memory of their own, ensuring the Live Oak Music Festival can continue to be a success for many years to come. For KCBX, I'm Kathy Johnston.
Kathy Johnston produced the story along with Steve Algrim at Opossumopolis Recording Studio in Los Osos. The Live Oak Music Festival is June 14th through the 16th, and tickets are available at liveoakfest.org. And finally, rattlesnakes. As our weather warms over the summer, we're approaching peak rattlesnake season in California, and that means more encounters between rattlers and humans. So what should we know about snakes? Emily Taylor, professor of biology at Cal Poly, is the author of the book California Snakes and How to Find Them. She had this conversation with Saul Gonzalez of the California Report.
You're listening to a diamondback rattlesnake that's been disturbed and is letting you know that it's ready to strike if you get any closer. As our weather warms over the summer, we're approaching peak rattlesnake season in California, and that means more encounters between rattlers and humans. And arguably, no one knows more about these creatures and their California snake relatives than Cal Poly San Luis Obispo biologist Emily Taylor. She's also a rattlesnake wrangler and the author of the new book, California Snakes and How to Find Them. I recently sat down with Taylor in San Luis Obispo to talk about snakes in the Golden State, starting with just how many kinds are slithering around out there.
California has an amazing diversity of snakes. We have at least 50 species of snakes, and part of the reason for that is it's a big state. It spans multiple latitudes. We have everything from the coast to the Central Valley, the Sierra Nevada, the Mojave Desert, all kinds of diversity of many animals, including snakes. We also have vast areas of undeveloped wildlands that are conducive to snake life. And so we have snakes of all kinds. We've got 7 species of rattlesnakes, which are the only venomous snake in California. We have multiple species of harmless snakes that fall into this one group called the colubrids. We even have some boas, including rosy boas and rubber boas, and a few other families as well. So it's really just an incredible place for snake diversity.
And they're in all of the ecosystems of California. Can they be found just about any place in the state?
Absolutely. So snakes can be found everywhere in the state, except for maybe dense urban areas. And even there, sometimes we get some species of snakes that work their way through people's backyards.
Out of that cornucopia of snakes, name a couple that stand out to you.
Well, one of the most beautiful snakes is called a mountain king snake. And they have red, black, and white alternating bands, meaning not stripes that go along their body, but bands that go around their body, much like a ring would on your finger. And they are kind of, in my book, I talk about how they're the white whale for many herpers, which are people who like to look for herps or reptiles and amphibians, because they're not so easy to find. They're oftentimes in mountains, as their name implies, although not always. In some places, they get down closer to sea level. And they're just stunningly beautiful. And these are animals that people go out in search of and sometimes never find.
What's another one?
One of my favorites is a rubber boa, and a rubber boa is a weird snake. They look like they're just kind of like a bag of skin. If you pick one up, their skin moves kind of independently of their muscle, and you can't tell which side is the head or the tail. Oftentimes, they will hide their head if you're harassing them and stick their tail out and try to get you to think that the tail is the head, so that if a predator goes to bite the head, they bite the tail instead. And so a lot of them have scars on their tails, which is pretty cool.
Could you talk about the role snakes play generally in our California ecosystem? What do they do that, being self-serving, could be helpful to human beings, for instance, or to the California's natural environment as a whole?
Snakes are incredibly important to California's natural environment. So snakes are all carnivores. All of them are going to eat things like rodents, lizards, some of them only eat insects, but they all eat other animals. And in that way, they play an important role in controlling the populations of those other animals. But also, all snakes get eaten by other animals themselves. And so they're what we call a mesopredator, meaning they both eat and are eaten. And that is a much stronger link in the ecological chain of the food web. So they play just a super important role. I should also say that a lot of snakes eat rodents, and many of those rodents are considered pests in some areas. They can carry some diseases like hantavirus and Lyme disease and even plague. And so snakes can contribute to keeping their populations at the appropriate level in check.
I want to talk about one kind of snake in particular, one that you often deal with, I know, through in your work, and that is rattlesnakes. What do we get right and what do we get wrong when it comes to rattlesnakes, which I think to a lot of Californians are the most fearsome kind of snake that's out there?
Yeah, I mean, I like to say that most everything people have heard about rattlesnakes is wrong, but there's usually a little seed of truth to it. So you hear a lot of myths, like it's a myth for the babies are more dangerous than the adults. That's not true. It's a myth that they're evolving to lose their rattles. That's not true. What I will say is that rattlesnakes are the only species of snakes that are capable of inflicting a very, very dangerous bite, potentially even deadly bite, if not treated medically. And so that is something to take very seriously.
Tell me something wonderful about rattlesnakes. What is something that just sort of awes you to this day after studying them for so long and being around them and handling them?
The most amazing thing about rattlesnakes is their social lives. So this was something that took me a long time, even as a herpetologist, to learn. Rattlesnakes form social bonds where they have friends that they hang out with, and especially that the mothers, when they give birth to live babies, so there's no rattlesnake eggs that hatch, they take care of the babies and they even help each other cooperatively take care of the babies. Research has shown that rattlesnakes that are together, that have a friend with them, react less to a stressful stimulus. So there's such a complex social system going on that we're just starting to learn about.
Let's talk about news you can use for people listening to us. As we speak, summer is starting, people are out and about more, are taking to the mountains, are taking to wilderness areas. What should they be thinking about snake-wise?
So rattlesnakes are the only potentially dangerous snakes in California. They will only bite to defend themselves. So if you keep your dogs on a leash, and if you watch where you're stepping on trails, and if you wear appropriate footwear. So what you should be wearing is full, thick leather hiking boots that cover your ankles. Almost every snake bite is going to be to the foot or the ankle. Just watching where you're stepping, too. I mean, most snake bite accidents occur if somebody steps right on one. Watch where you put your hands and feet. Get your dog, like I said, keep them on a leash. Also have them trained to avoid rattlesnakes. You can train your dog by a professional training to back away from rattlesnakes. Otherwise, if you do see a snake, just give it space, 10 feet around it, take photos, enjoy it, admire it, text them to me so I can admire them, and go about your business and kind of normalize seeing snakes in nature. They belong there. They've been there for millions and millions of years, a lot longer than we have, and it's just up to us to stay safe around them.
All right, Emily Taylor, author of California Snakes and How to Find Them. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Saul.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.